Brett West, Operations Division Administrator at DAS. And my presentation begins on page 455. The Miscellaneous Receipts and Special Governments Payments section is basically a service DAS provides to pass through money from a number of different sources. Our primary role is to make sure that we're following the law and accurately distributing these funds. We don't have much of a role in monitoring what happens with them other than to do the subrecipient monitoring on the federal funds that's required by OMB Circular A-133. On page 456 and 457 and continuing on 458, you'll see the different revenue streams that we have available to us. Because we don't have much time this morning, I won't go over each one of those unless you have specific questions on any of those. On page 459, you can see the dollar amounts associated with the distributions, where we get the money. Page 460 and 461 shows where the money goes to in broad categories. These items actually don't show up as expenditures in DAS's budget because they're miscellaneous revenue distributions that we're just getting out to other agencies and local governments so that they can do their job. The items listed on page 463 are ones that actually do show up as expenditures in our budget, and I'd like to talk about those a little more specifically. The one that I'd like to draw your attention to is the item number 4 on that table, the PERS blended rate charges. Excuse me. The federal government found that we were basically overcharging federal-funded agencies for the PERS blended rate, and we've entered into a settlement agreement with them to repay $4.5 million from prior to fiscal year 2004. We continue to work with the feds. We have $6.4 million appropriation this biennium to pay those penalties, and we carry that into next biennium. And we are working with our payroll system and with PERS to get the both of those systems reprogrammed so that beginning July 1st of this year, we won't have this penalty situation and hopefully won't have to make these payments again. There will be an effect on some federal funded agencies, but the bigger effect could be on higher PERS rates for corrections, state police, and those kind of agencies that actually have the higher police and firefighter PERS rates. And I can, if you have questions about that, I can talk a little bit more about that. We are working hard to get that cleaned up so we don't have to worry about that in the future. And hopefully you'll never have to hear me talk about that again. The only other thing that I'd talk about before I quickly wrap up is on page 464, the transit district payments that we send to local transit districts around the state. We collect those and pay those out. Those show up as an expenditure, about $15.8 million for the 709 biennium is our estimate. And it's basically, again, an accounting function. We pass the money through without much in the way of any program activities that we're required to do. And because it's that simple, I will close and see if you have any questions.
Representative Cuomo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brett, I noticed on page 459 the transfers from the Education Stability Fund. Why is there anticipated $20 million in the governor's recommended budget, considering that our economy is pricking along and we shouldn't be pulling any money out of that fund?
Mr. Chair, there's actually a statutory direction on how the funds are to be distributed. For the details of why we're doing that, I'll have to go back in and make sure that I check with Budget and Management section to see what the details of that are.
That'd be fine. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any other questions?
Mr. Kinney in to address the disbursements for the pension obligation bonds. And
okay. All right. Mr. Kinney?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jack Kenny. I'm the Finance Manager, Budget Management Division, Department of Administrative Services. Mr. Wayan to ask that I talk briefly today about a couple issues due to some questions that he's had from committee members. So I'm going to cover just briefly the pension obligation bond payments that are assessed through our department and the appropriation bonds. My understanding that the reason that the questions arose were that the fact that typically or historically when we issue bonds, there's level debt service. That's basically like you'd see on a normal mortgage where the principal interest payments combined are roughly the same through the course of the payment history. For pension obligation bonds, that's not the case, and you know, we expect that the assessments will increase over time. And let me describe or explain why that is. We had a unique situation in 2003. We had an unfunded actuarial liability of about $2 billion, just over $2 billion. We had a unique market opportunity because long-term taxable interest rates were under 6%. We were essentially paying through the contribution rates, 8% interest on that $2 billion outstanding liability. Because of those unique market conditions, we had an opportunity essentially to lock in a lower cost for that liability of roughly 5.7%. So in 2003, the governor and the legislature made the decision to go ahead and lock in those savings, take advantage of those unique market conditions. So what we did was we issued approximately $2 billion in pension obligation bonds. However, the policy decision at the time by the legislature and the governor was to, because this was simply exchanging one liability for another, a pension type liability for a bond liability, they would structure the bonds to match the pension liability that it replaced. So I, on the charts that I've asked to be distributed, you'll see one that shows unfunded, it's titled Unfunded Actuarial Liability Amortization and Pension Bond Payments. The chart with the squares on the top was the expectation in 2003 of what the state was going to have to pay for pension obligation bond liability. And the next chart with the diamonds is essentially what we expect to pay or what we expected to pay at the time on pension obligation bonds. So you can see that it essentially mirrors what we would have paid through the PERS rates. So And the difference between those two lines is the savings that we locked in. Savings that was anticipated at the time, gross savings, not present value savings, but gross savings was over $900 million. So that's what we did. But you can also see from that line with the diamonds that the pension obligation bond assessments that will be made to state government agencies through 2027 will be increasing over time. The logic and the theory behind that is the same theory and logic that's used for pension assessments, that as payroll grows, and then there's an actuarial assumption on the rate of payroll growth, if we use a constant percentage of payroll, we'll be able to fund that debt. So the theory was that if, for example, you're paying 5%, 10%, whatever it is, of payroll to cover the pension obligation bond, you do the same thing for pension liabilities through the PERS system, you do the same thing for the pension bonds. So the theory was, let's keep the rate that's charged against payroll a constant rate. That's in theory how it was going to work. That was the theory that the actuary used when he set the PERS rates. So if he set a 5% of the PERS rate to cover your pension liability through PERS rates, that would be the same over time, but the gross dollar amount would increase. That's the same phenomena that we're looking at with the pension bonds. The rate should be the same, but the gross dollars will be increasing. So that's why you'll see an increase in the pension obligation bond assessment by DAS through 2027. Now, I guess one other point, and I don't want to bore you too much on this issue, but we are still able to get the same benefit that we would have gotten under the actuarial methods before. We essentially deposited that $2 billion into the PERS fund at the time of the sale. So now, in recent years, we've had earnings on that $2 billion that have been over the 8% assumption. So what that has resulted in is a reduction in PERS rates. You won't see it, at least based on the pension liability piece that we funded. At the time that we sold the bonds, they expected that the reduction in the PERS rate would be 6.6%, all other things equal. Currently, the actuarial valuation that just came out, the reduction in PERS rates relative to this pension lump sum side account is 9.47%. So because we've earned more than 8%, the reduction from having this side account has actually improved. So I suppose if earnings go down below 8% in the future, then it'd go the other way. But currently, having this side account is actually yielding more savings than was initially projected. I think that covers it, unless you have any questions.
And, excuse me, Jack, would you let us know when the appropriation bonds are scheduled to be paid off?
Okay, the next issue is the appropriation bonds. They are final maturity in 2013. There was another unique situation in 2003 when the state decided to, that we had a deficit and we needed to, I guess, balance the books. So we had that unique situation where we actually borrowed money to fund the deficit in 2003. Those were 10-year bonds, appropriation bonds. Again, the amount of payments is not level debt service as a historic bond would be, where the payments are the same every year. They will also increase. This was a policy decision that was based on the structure of the National Tobacco Settlement, it's called the Master Settlement Agreement, and the amounts of money that were coming to Oregon increased in 2008, I believe. The chart shows it, yes. For the six years beginning in 2008, there's a bump, if you will, in the Master Settlement Agreement payments to Oregon. I talked to people at the DOJ, and the reason for that is that Oregon was very close when the Master Settlement Agreement was signed to going to court on its own for settlement. I think we were a month away from filing. And so in recognition of the work that Oregon had already done in preparing its individual Attorney General action against the national tobacco companies, there was a recognition of that, and states like Oregon, Washington, that were kind of ahead of the curve, if you will, had a larger bump. Typically, the tobacco settlements based on, I believe, consumption and tobacco and per capita, those types of things. But we do have a bump starting in 2008 based on our legal work. So the policymakers at the time structured the appropriation bonds to have a higher repayment in the years to correspond to the increasing tobacco settlement revenues that were anticipated.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. Mr. Kennedy, I wonder if you could discuss the total principal interest payments.
The total principal and interest payments that will be due and payable over with the creative type of financing against the compared to the traditional type, and then compare that also with the savings in PERS contributions as a result of that, and kind of give us, and I don't know if you have that, you know, available, but
I do. Had we gone with level debt service as opposed to the level savings approach, we would have saved about $1.1 billion, not quite $1.1 billion versus the $900 million round numbers. However, we would have been in a larger deficit position in the early years. We, as you can see from the chart, using the level debt service approach, we would have had to pay more in, I believe the lines cross at about 2012. So we were already in a deficit position. We would have further exacerbated that situation. So I believe that was a factor in choosing the approach we did. But as I said, the savings would be about just over $1 billion using the level debt service versus the $900 million using the level savings approach.
Follow up?
Yes. Then that would have been about $100 million difference, or between $100 and $200 million difference.
That's Mr. Chair, Senator Whitson, that's correct. However, that doesn't factor in additional costs of borrowing because we were in a deficit position. So, but had we had the money, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Are there questions? Mr. Kenny?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony and time. Are we all?
With this portion of the budget.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll get the public testimony. We have at least one person.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Paul. We'll be back with you somewhere down the line. At this point, we're going to open a public testimony relating to the Oregon Progress Board. A couple of folks here. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Jensen and members of the committee. This is Duncan Wise, who is the president of the Oregon Business Council, and he's here to testify on behalf of the Progress Board.
Reed, would you?
For the record, that was Rita.
Oh, sorry.
Rita Conrad with the Oregon Progress Board introducing Mr. Wise.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Duncan Wise, president of the Oregon Business Council. In full disclosure, I was the original executive director of the Oregon Progress Board, so I do have a personal and long-term interest in this organization, but I am here to speak on behalf of my members of the Oregon Business Council, representing about 45 business executives from around the state. We strongly support the Progress Board and have consistently over the years because we think it's a vital piece of what Oregon needs to plan and plan for its future and make the right decisions in support of the future of Oregon. As we use the Progress Board's work throughout in our work, and I'll describe that in a moment, and we just think it's a vital piece of what Oregon needs to move forward. We see it include, as Rita presented last week, and the three major components of the Progress Board, the work on the vision, Oregon Shines 1 and 2, and looking forward to Oregon Shines 3, taking a broad look at where Oregon, the trends in Oregon, and where Oregon is going, and what a vision for the future is. And we think that work in the community, helping Oregonians understand the trends and forces affecting our state and to really to paint a picture of what we want in the future is a really important part of what we need to do as a community to move forward in these times. The second piece, vitally important, are the benchmarks themselves, indicators of how Oregon is doing. The data speaks loudly when things are going well and when things aren't going well. And we understand that it's a discipline, an important discipline for the state to measure how we're doing and compare and contrast ourselves with other states and countries. And having the benchmarks, we think, is vitally important. And finally, the work that the vision and strategy and benchmarks play in a variety of different settings, including state government specifically, the performance management system that the Progress Board has supported and really spearheaded. But I would also point out that the Progress Board's work really infuses in a whole variety of places in the community. And I want to just use our organization as one example just to give you an idea of how widely the Progress Board's work is used. In our work at the Business Council, of course, you're, I hope, familiar with the Oregon Business Plan and the Policy Playbook. If you look at it and the guiding framework for it, it is based on Oregon Shines. We use the vision of Oregon Shines, the jobs, the environment, and strong, healthy communities as the basic starting point of all our work. And we use the data from the benchmarks to help assess how we're doing as a state. And again, you'll see it woven throughout all our policy work, both at the broad level and individual initiatives. We also work with the Progress Board in terms of the Oregon Business Plan to measure how we're doing in terms of the economy. If you don't have the competitive index, we publish it every year jointly with the Progress Board. Rita helps us in developing the data. It's a collaborative effort to take a look at the benchmarks, particularly around the business plan, and we wave it right into the business plan. The third area we use the Progress Board are the benchmarks themselves. Every 2 years when the report comes out, we have the Progress Board come before the council, share the data, and we have a very robust conversation. I know those kinds of conversations happen all around the state when Rita goes out and talks about the benchmarks. It happens, I've seen it also at the county level. I serve on county boards, and we bring the benchmarks to assess how we're doing in terms of the county level data. The benchmarks really promote a very robust conversation about how we're doing, and I think that's vital throughout the state in our communities. And I would stress again on the benchmarks, we don't always like what we see, and there's a great line from Total Quality Management literature that says, data will set you free, but first it'll piss you off. And and it really does. I mean, you know, we don't always like what we see in the benchmarks. And, you know, when we started this years ago, we said, you know, this isn't necessarily going to be a easy journey to measure ourselves. There'll be points along the way where we're really going to be disappointed with ourselves, and you'll want to blame the progress board for the messenger, but they're just the messenger. They're giving us the data, and we need to use it. So again, I see it weaving in our own organization and other work I've done. We work closely with a lot of foundations. I know they're supportive of this work and use it as well. So I really want to strongly support the board. As we look ahead into the next couple of years, we are in a moment where I think we do need to refresh the vision of Oregon Shines. I know Rita talked with you about Oregon Shines 3. We're thinking about how it can potentially connect to the 150th birthday of the state. We're already working with Rita. I know a number of foundations are working with Rita to try to create a collaborative effort to really go out and have a broad conversation with Oregon about what do we need to do next? What's our future? Where are we trying to take our state? And what do we need to be working on to move ourselves forward in terms of the economy, in terms of education, environment, community development, and a variety of other ways? And we really would look forward to working with the Progress Board on that effort. In terms of the budget, I know that's your responsibility. It's a very small budget. It's way too small, in my opinion, to do all the work it's doing. They do a fantastic job. They've got great presentations, websites, materials. I don't know how they do it with the resources they have. I would encourage you to at least adopt the governor's budget, and if you're so inclined, to look at additional resources along the way. But again, it's a real good, I think it's a vital investment for Oregon. I encourage you to support the Progress Board. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wise. Any questions? Senator Johnson.
A couple of questions and a comment. Let me start with a comment. I ended up just serendipitously being one of the founding board members of the private not-for-profit that is now doing the Oregon Sesquicentennial. They are in the process of adopting undertakings, and I think this, if you haven't talked to them, would be a unique opportunity.
Yes.
To have them embrace. I'm seeing Rita going, we have some.
Yes, we have.
And we'll move on then.
Madam Chair, I'm just impressed that you can say that word. I've been working on it.
If I can say bovine spongiform encephalopathy, I practiced that for weeks before I carried that bill. Anyway, it's a unique time.
Yes, totally agree.
To get in the queue with them.
Yes.
The next thing, I guess, that I've observed and wondered about since I've been in the legislature is the connect point with the legislature and the Progress Board. There seems over time to be a sort of fundamental disconnect, and the biggest disconnect comes when we run out of money, because the Progress Board is one of those that gets hit early and often.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm trying to figure out how to make sure that the legislature fully participates in the data. And other than these hearings, I'm not sure where the touch point is, and asking two employees with a very modest budget to take on more is difficult. But I'm trying to get that balance between you could gather this data with a private contract with a data collection firm, make it relevant to the 90 people in here who are theoretically making policy decisions based on good information.
Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair.
Rita's going to pop, Mr. Chair, if you don't let her come up.
Let me tell you my history. I totally agree with you on the need for, and Rita, you might want to chime in here. I want you to think about the Progress Board at two broad levels, one around vision and benchmarks, which speak to the fundamental goals that we're trying to accomplish for the state, and then the performance management system that the state is developing that connect with these larger benchmarks but really speak to the performance of state agencies. And they're very different. Just to give an example, a benchmark might be reducing the poverty rate in Oregon. When you look at a human resource agency, say Adult and Family Services, they would have specific measurable goals related to accomplishing that larger objective. When we started the benchmarks, I spent a lot of time with the policy committees in the legislature. I think Representative Jensen was in a number of those committees, when I actually went around committee by committee and asked the committees to look at the benchmarks, give us feedback on them, and then we adjusted the benchmarks based on what we heard in the committees. And I found that to be a very robust conversation, often at the beginning, I think it was towards the beginning of the session in most cases, to have the committees really focus on their own goals. I mean, where are we trying to go in education or on natural resource policy? And frankly, after the first round, it was very time-consuming, and there is a really small staff, and we weren't able to continue to do that. If Rita had the budget and time, I think that would continue to be a good exercise as one way of refreshing the benchmarks and reminding you of how we're doing by major policy area. I know, again, there's the performance measures, and a lot of the progress board's work is seen through that process, but I actually think the more important part in a lot of ways are focusing on those larger goals and asking, are we taking the steps to really achieve them as a community, including the role of the legislature?
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Duncan, you're making my point. The question is that you're going around and shopping, let's say, natural resource mm-hmm. policy. Mm-hmm. I can't think of a more divisive or volatile issue in this building.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Whitsitt comes from a place vastly different from Representative Galizio.
Mm-hmm.
And my question for them is, how often or what is the methodology or vehicle to refresh the benchmarks to make sure that they capture the concerns of Klamath County as well as they do Washington County?
I love that, Rita.
One of the things, Chair Jensen, members of the committee, Rita Conrad, Progress Board, one of the things we do is we do break about a third of the benchmarks down by county and recreate those county data books. Many of the environmental benchmarks, however, are not in there. What we need to do, I think, in Oregon Shines 3, as we launch that, is approach local governments to be a part of that conversation when we review the benchmarks. To me, that's a very important aspect of Oregon Shines 3.
I guess the point I'm trying to make is that if we are holding the Progress Board and their work product out to be our roadmap to what we want Oregon to be, I don't know what the indices are that everybody in this building, let alone Oregonians, have signed up.
Madam Vice Chair, I agree with you. I mean, again, that's what I was really speaking to. I think there's a strong argument for bringing the natural resource benchmarks to the Natural Resource Committee to review. Behind the benchmarks are the benchmarks basically are a way of quantitatively reflecting our vision for what we want out of natural resources. And I would encourage the legislature to have a discussion of those benchmarks. Frankly, natural resource benchmarks have always been controversial, and they raise a lot of policy issues. But I think that kind of dialogue is very, very valuable. And I find when you have it around those measurable goals, you often clarify the vision and really help bring folks together. Because actually, I think we have more agreement on some of these issues than we realize if we actually.
Don't hold your breath.
Well, it's. I can hold my breath
Senator
for a while.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. To follow up on Senator Johnson's questions, if I may, I'm concerned that we're really not getting the input of individual Oregonians as opposed to getting the input of various different levels of Oregon government in the Progress Board's input in their, you know, when you're looking to redo Oregon Shines. I'd like to see more individual public input. And you know, one of the primary goals of government is and should be to protect the minority group. And many of the folks in natural resources industries now, in ag, timber, and so forth, are definitely a minority. And I think we need to hear from each of those and then weigh that in the context of the county and the area that they come from, as opposed to where the preponderance of the input will come from an area that is dissimilar to that.
Senator, Representative Jensen, Chair Jensen, and Senator Whitsitt, I couldn't agree with you more, and I'm sure Duncan agrees 100%. One of the reasons Oregon Shines 3 is so overdue is because it's been 10 years since those conversations have happened. When we did Oregon Shines 2, a lot of those regional meetings and local discussions happened, and we very much need to revisit those again. Part of the design for Oregon Shines 3 will be that kind of grassroots involvement and a dialogue across Oregon.
Senator Whitsitt.
Yes. What will be the methodology of that? I mean, will you do that on a questionnaire basis, attached to income tax returns? I mean, or will you do the infamous stakeholder groups, which most people don't go to anymore? Or how will you go about doing that?
We haven't worked out all the details on that, but it will certainly involve some regional meetings. The Oregon Shines 3 is in the proposal stage right now. We're just beginning to work out some of the issues with that. So I want to address your concerns when we get to them, though.
And just to follow up, Senator Whitson, we want to be involved in that from the council. In earlier rounds, for example, the Business Council conducted the Values and Beliefs Study, which was a statewide survey of individual Oregonians just for that purpose. So we broke that data out by regions, again, just for that purpose, so that we could hear not just from community leaders, and we did back in those days. I remember the 29 community meetings we did with electronic voting. We were all over the state, and that was very helpful. And I would anticipate in this round, if we move forward with the Progress Board, the foundations and business community would support that kind of in-depth analysis of Oregonians' opinions. And I would agree with you completely. It can't just be community meetings. The community meetings are valuable, and we can generate a lot from community leaders in community meetings. But if you don't talk with individual Oregonians through, you know, through various survey techniques, you're not going to get all the messages we need to get in terms of where Oregonians are.
But got a question.
I was two things. I was going to make a pitch for those big public meetings. I went to one of them. It seems longer than 10 years ago, where they did electronic voting. It was a room of about a bazillion. I think you were there. They had instant replay, so that the whole room would be asked through this electronic measurement to say, what do you think about X? And it would flash. There was a pretty good cross-section. It was fascinating to see the results come back that quickly. The other thing that has long been an issue before this committee is the question of, if this service is so valuable, where's the buy-in? And I may have missed your presentation, Rita, and for that I apologize, but the curiosity that I have is, how many Elio Massonary institutions support your work by grants? What private sector participation is there? If this is as valuable as it is portrayed and believed to be in some quarters, who else has skin in the game? Who else supports you financially other than just the state?
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, at the present time, the public sector is the sole funder of the Progress Board, but we are definitely exploring a business sector, independent sector, public sector partnership with Oregon Shines 3, with a possible consideration of that as permanent funding for the Progress Board down the road.
Colleagues, I would just submit that I think that there is a role to see value expressed tangibly. And at one time, when the Progress Board looked as though it was going to slip beneath the waves in one of the multiple special sessions, there was a challenge issued to the Progress Board. Go out and have foundations validate your work by their fiscal participation. And there were a couple of grants. But my question is the data you're collecting, if it's used as widely as Mr. Wise says it is, and I believe that it is, what about the fee for service for the level of sophisticated data collection that you're doing? Some additional participation besides just public money.
Madam Vice Chair, I think that's a good question. I think we are, as Rita says, we're exploring that. I mean, if you're this as a state agency with state funds, it's not the first place foundations or business thinks of making contributions. But if we wanted to explore the idea of a collaborative process to fund the Progress Board, I think there'd be potentially significant interest. I would just point out we have invested over the years quite a bit in the Progress Board. Again, Oregon Shines 2, we raised money privately. The Values and Beliefs Study really was done in collaboration with the Progress Board. And from the Business Council point of view, we've done a lot of work with it, and I think we've reinforced and supported its work. But I think the question is a good one. I mean, the Progress Board's vision and the benchmarks are really for the entire state, not just state government. And finding a way to support it, both in terms of the board membership as well as funding in a variety of ways, is worth exploring. I don't have a check to write for you this morning, but I know we've talked about that, and I've talked about it with some foundations. And again, none of them have committed, but if you'd like to explore that, it would probably mean a different structure for the Progress Board. I don't think you're going to have investors without, you know, wanting to, you know, more explicit ways of participating with it. We need to think about that. But I think, you know, certainly around projects and potentially the board itself, I think there's some possibilities there.
I hate to be the wet blanket here this morning, but I'm going to conclude this portion of our morning hearing. I am, however, going to ask that Rita, maybe you and Duncan, make an appointment to come and see me sometime. I have some harebrained ideas as we're talking here, but we'll pursue. I want to pursue those a little more.
Chair Jensen, thank you very much.
You have a question.
Mr. Chair, what I was just going to ask while they're changing places here is, at the end of our meeting, if we have time after the other two things, because I know you want to move on, could we revisit this? Because there's a couple of things that I'd like to get on the record, but and questions that I'd like to ask them, if that's all right. If we don't have time,
that's fine. I would be happy to do that and be happy to personally listen to your questions and when I meet with them pursue further that.
Thank you.
All right. Moving quickly on, then, we go to the Oregon Public Broadcasting and Tony Van Pleet and Steve Bass, I think. And
thank you.
It looks to me like they've got some reinforcements with that are not on my...
And I always bow to the other side of the aisle and make sure that their name is there.
Mr. Chair, while this distinguished panel is coming up, for the benefit of some of our colleagues who may be new to the process, Mr. Van Vliet comes before us not just as an advocate for OPB, but as a former legislator and former co-chair and a distinguished longtime member of this body.
Thank you very much.
Be careful with that question.
Kid gloves for the guy in the room.
Why does he look so healthy now?
I'd also like to point out to the distinguished guest from OPB that he read a story last week on distinguished Senator Rick Welch's. And I would point out it's Rich Metzger from Welch's. Okay. Who's this new senator, Senator Welch's, they're talking about? It took me a while to figure it out.
Oh,
no.
Well, since all of those things have taken place.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Tony Van Vliet from Corvallis, and I'm past chair of the board of OPB. And on my right is Steve Bass, our new president and CEO of OPB, and on my left is the Doug Tinnell, current chairman of the board of OPB. I am not going to swamp you with a lot of data. I am going to just talk about two things, since I'm sort of the institutional memory wonk on the board about budgeting, and I brought just two pages into you, and that is a bar chart, if that's been passed out. You got that in front of you? I want to refer to that because it shows a very dramatic change in funding of OPB, and it needs some explanation. In the 1981-83, we were in the most severe recession that Oregon had seen in several decades, and you will see at that time that OPB was funded at $3.6 million. In 1991-93, when I was co-chair of Ways and Means and we were initiating ballot measure 5 and scrambling for money for schools, we still felt a strong obligation to funding both OPB and the Oregon Historical Society as essential parts of the Oregon fabric. So those are, and you saw that there is a great slippage after that period of time. And in 1991, it was a major change. Also, a bill, Senate Bill 168, went in that made us a nonprofit, quasi-public-private organization. And the second page explains a very interesting aspect of that particular bill, and that is in Section 12. And it said the state recognizes a continued financial partnership with Oregon Public Broadcasting and the citizens of Oregon, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is essential to the preservation of statewide access to the public broadcasting service, educational programming services, broadcasts for the disabled. And I bring that to your attention mainly because of the slippage that we did have. We did go under the waves in the crisis that you faced in 2003. So we are back. And with a new president of our organization, I'm going to turn it over to Steve Bass to talk to you about both our needs and what we hope to achieve in this legislative session.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Before we switch from sort of the Yoda of OPB to Mr. Bass, and in the interest of full disclosure, I served on OPB's board for 15 or so years. but you've done something that I think makes me a little tiny bit grouchy, and I want you to help me with this.
Okay.
Looking at your bar charts, what OPB seems to periodically forget is the infusion of $7 million in lottery funds that, as I recall, occurred in 2001.
That's correct.
And it just sort of mystically disappears off the bar chart.
Well, I can tell you it didn't disappear off my
bar chart.
Okay.
It basically, I think, I'll let Steve speak to that. And that was a big infusion at that time to help us out. There was no question about that. We were in tough shape at that moment. And it didn't go unappreciated either.
But it goes unrepresented. And unless I'm missing something, it just doesn't appear here. It's part of your continuing state financial relationship. And what you just said made it sound as though the state hadn't done anything. There's $7 million of bonding in here that we're still paying on.
This is operational budget here.
Okay. Well, maybe Mr. Bass will touch on it, but I just don't want that $7 million to just turn into an oops somewhere.
And we are forever graciously appreciative of that, because we know you helped make that so.
Cool.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Steve Bass, President and CEO of Oregon Public Broadcasting. I would like to introduce a couple of folks that are here with me. My colleague, Mark Stanislawski, behind me here, who is from Southern Oregon Public Television, which covers the southern part of our state, is an important partner with us, and between the two of us, we cover nearly every single citizen in the state of Oregon. Also, I believe Dave Henderson is here. The legislative administrator, and we have a very important partnership that the three of us have struck up to run a new channel called the Oregon Channel that I'm sure many of you are aware of that is carrying proceedings just like this to television viewers mostly in range of our current digital infrastructure in the Willamette Valley, in the Medford, Klamath Falls area, Bend, and out towards LeGrand, and we hope that will be expanded shortly. I also should mention that we're really very pleased to be part of this bill, Senate Bill 5502, because I think it represents part of the governor's cultural reinvestment package to revitalize institutions like OPB, promote the arts and culture through the Oregon Historical Society, the Oregon Arts Commission, and other institutions like that. Let me speak for a moment as to what this request is for. There is $3.75 million in this appropriation, which is stated in the bill, I believe, as restoring the funding that OPB previously received. Well, it used to be that OPB received about, I believe, $3.5 million per biennium for operating support. This request actually is divided into two parts. $2.75 million of this request is to provide support for the build-out of what are soon to be useless translators that cover a large part of Oregon that are going to be required in the next couple of years. And that $2.75 million would provide 50% of the funding that we would need in order to do that for both us and Southern Oregon Public Television. The other half we think we can get from federal sources. The $1 million in the rest of it would provide operating funding to support the provision of broadcast services in rural areas of our state. And I'll speak a little bit more about that in a moment. As I mentioned, together with Southern Oregon Public Television, we reach practically all of Oregon's homes and communities, which allows all of Oregon's citizens to benefit from all sorts of cultural information and locally produced programs, including, I would hope you know, Oregon Field Guide, which has been covering the wonders of our state for the last 17 years, Oregon Art Beat, and a new series that we've started that we co-produce now with the Oregon Historical Society called the Oregon Experience.
One of the other parts of OPB that you may not be quite so familiar with is that we serve as beyond it just being a broadcaster, we serve as the backbone of the state's emergency broadcast and Amber Alert communication systems. So through our network, which reaches far and wide, further than any commercial broadcast network or group of stations in the state, we reach into communities that those stations would not dare to go because they're just not big enough. There are not enough listeners or viewers there to make it worthwhile. So we serve as the distribution point for all of the emergency alerting systems in Amber Alert and have done that for many years. The challenge we have, and I'm sure this is of no surprise to this legislature, is that we serve a state with greatly varying population topography, and being an East Coast native and having lived in the Mid-South, I've never really appreciated rural until I've moved to Oregon, because the distance and the wide open spaces between communities here is absolutely astounding. And frankly, I think a lot of the folks in Washington, D.C. don't fully appreciate that as much as they should. So, yes?
It would appear to the chair that there are a lot of folks in Oregon that don't appreciate that much. Especially, if I might, Mr. Bass, the geography of Oregon seems to, be a lesson that people on the telephone at OPB don't have a very good understanding of when they're suggesting that folks in my district tune in to a station in Eugene. So we
have given them remedial geography lessons, I can assure you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I know the difference between Eugene and Pendleton, because I have spent time in both places and know they are nowhere near each other.
Mr. Chair, until Mr. Bass has certification that he has driven to Jordan Valley.
I have not been there yet, Senator.
That's the threshold to establish your bona fides about knowing about rural Oregon.
Can I wait till spring?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. Mr. Bass, I represent a rural natural resources-based district about a third of Oregon. And there is that perception out there in the rural areas that some of PBS's programming is politically motivated, and some of it is some of the education agenda may be politically driven. How do you monitor the content of your of PBS programming? Do you make any effort to see that that's fair and balanced on a consistent basis?
Absolutely. We do that through a number of ways. First of all, our national organizations have ombudsmen, which allow citizens that have concerns about specific programs to voice them. And in some cases, they get reviewed and find that there were errors or omissions in them. Doesn't happen very often, but it does happen. Secondly, we are not like network television or radio stations, is that we have complete and utter choice as to what we choose to run. We are not under any contracts to run any particular programs. We also do a lot of surveying, both here locally and also nationally, to get the public's perception. I will tell you that the public's perception is that we are quite balanced overall, that the vast majority of folks don't find any kind of political agenda. We are home, for example, to the most respected news program on television, the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. And that's not to say that there aren't occasional disagreements with individual programs. I would submit that there certainly are. Our hope is that over the course of a schedule, we have a balance of those viewpoints. I also would like to point out that not having a state appropriation for the past 5 years, and what I'm talking about today, is not so much an investment in programming, which we think, frankly, is best left up to individual contributors and corporations and foundations and other funding sources that we've been very successful in achieving. Where we need the help is in the infrastructure that is really threatened now due to the large costs of carrying that signal into the rural parts of the state. We have been very successful the last 5 years since our state appropriation in increasing the support of viewers and listeners. It now accounts for about 65% of our broadcast operations, which if you were to compare to any operation around the country that is, covers a similar geographic area, is much, much larger. I believe we're the only state statewide organization of this size and this scale that has no support from the state government. On the one hand, that's a point of pride. But I will say that for the future, that points to a significant challenge as we struggle to serve those parts of the state where there are not sufficient numbers of viewers or listeners that if we were to kind of pencil it out on a, gee, does this pay for itself, it probably does not. As you can imagine, our contributors are very heavily clustered in the metropolitan areas around Portland, the Willamette Valley. Marks are clustered around Medford and obviously Klamath, Bend, and Redmond. 80% of our contributors live in 8 counties, only one of which is east of the Cascades. That's Deschutes, and of course, Deschutes County is growing like a weed, and we expect that's going to continue. So we've been able to
understand that Deschutes County is probably not really considered Eastern Oregon.
I think it's Eastern Oregon in that it's, you know, it's over the hill. I would call it Central Oregon.
And that's maybe a better reference to it, but.
Yep.
Just as a matter of illustration for the geography lesson to continue, it's as far for
yes.
me to go to Bend as it is to come to Salem.
I understand that, Mr. Chairman. I think that's why I refer to it as east of the Cascades, not eastern Oregon.
That's good.
You'll get a rope in certain quarters if you get that wrong.
I think I'm getting it already. One thing I wanted to point out to you is I have two charts attached to my written testimony, and the first chart is a relative cost per home served by our current broadcast services. And you can see, and this would make perfect sense to those of you who have labored on balancing the delivery of services across the state, that the cost of serving rural parts of the state is much, much higher than it is in the urban areas. And for us, that gets borne out in a couple of ways. For example, in true eastern Oregon, out near Pendleton, we have a broadcast transmitter in La Grande, and we have about a dozen translators, which are little tiny transmitters all over that area. We have 2 engineers that are out there. We have to pay electrical bills, and one of the surprises I had when I came to OPB is I found out that we actually own a snowcat. And the way I found this out is that we had to get the treads changed, and it was going to cost $17,000 to do this. I haven't even gotten to drive this thing, so I'm hoping when I go out to La Grande in March, I can go catch up with the engineers and actually get to see this thing. But we have equipment in some of the most remote areas of the state in order to bring broadcast services into those communities, to deliver to cable system, to deliver to homes, as well as to bring the amber and the emergency alerts there. But as you can see, the cost in the Portland area is about 48 cents per home. And I would call, and we've kind of carved this up based on the way our engineering staff works geographically. Eastern Oregon is about 11 times more expensive. Central Oregon, Mr. Chairman, is about 9 times more expensive. And Mark's area down in southern Oregon is a little less expensive than eastern Oregon, but not a lot. So as you can see, it's a significant cost that we've been having to bear. Now, one of the big challenges we have, and we have been able to manage and hold on to this network, and our board and top management is very committed to maintaining this, mostly because we realize that public broadcasting is the only electronic media institution that ties this entire state together. We are starting to see other media pull out of rural Oregon. As an example, the Oregonian used to have delivery into rural areas. They no longer do that. We do need a civic space, if you will, or a civic voice that is going to bring issues both to rural Oregon and bring the concerns and issues of rural Oregon to the rest of the population. There's a new urgency to this situation, and this is the main reason we are here with you today. As Senator Johnson mentioned to you, the state, under her leadership in 2001, made a big investment in OPB, $7 million, which helped us to leverage an additional $15 million in federal and private funds to upgrade our transmission system to digital. I don't know how much you know about digital television, but the federal government a number of years ago essentially mandated that all television broadcasters would have to put on parallel digital broadcast facilities. And at some point, we would have to turn off the old analog system and give it back to the government. Well, that date is now at hand. On February 17, 2009, the federal government is going to shut down the analog broadcast system in the United States. What that means for OPB is that in the areas where the state has invested those funds, we have been able to transition our 7 broadcast transmitters, 5 of OPB's and 2 of Southern Oregon Public Television's, to the digital format. We have approximately 55 translators out, not necessarily just in rural areas, but in some of the areas that one would not normally consider rural, such as the coast, and areas down in Southern Oregon, where without translators we cannot get signals into those communities. That system is analog. This is one of the areas that the federal government has really lagged. Back in 2001, when my predecessor and others stood before the legislature about the 7 million, there was no plan at that time for what they were going to do with those translators. They have only recently formulated that plan. So the situation we are facing is that we have to make an investment at this critical time in that rural infrastructure. Otherwise, sometime shortly after 2009, that system will be forced to be shut down by the federal government. It's part of the mandate that you go digital or you shut it off. As we look at the investment that's required, we feel quite confident that half of the money could come from the federal government. We think that this is a very, very critical issue at this particular point in time. Personally, I'm very concerned about what is going to happen to people in rural Oregon on February 18th when they turn on their analog TV sets and they no longer work. In fact, I'm worried about what's going to happen in the metropolitan areas because people are very, very confused about this. But I think there's another thing here, and I don't come before you to say that this is just a problem. I think there is a very, very good opportunity here as well. As we go digital, we have the ability to carry much more than just television programming into various communities. We can carry multiple channels of programming. So, for example, right now we are using a portion of our digital television signal to carry the Oregon Channel into homes and into cable systems in the Willamette Valley, in Southern Oregon, around Bend, and out into LeGrand. That service, which we are in partnership with Legislative Media and the Oregon University System, cannot go out on the analog transmission system. So it is not going to be available in Pendleton, Baker City, anywhere on the coast. It will not be available in Burns, Lakeview, any other place where we reach by translators. And if you care to turn to the last page, you can actually see a picture of the coverage area of the broadcast transmitters. The blue is essentially the effective reach of our digital broadcast transmitters, and anything else is places we cannot reach without the translator. So you can see, for example, that the entire coast cannot be reached. We've got a few little mountains that Coast Range kind of gets in the way. We've then got the Cascades, and of course, many communities in the Gorge, down towards Burns, Ontario, et cetera, that we will not be able to reach without those translators. Once we are fully digital, we can do more things than provide just programs. We are doing a number of pilot projects right now with distributing data over that system, because essentially it is just like a one-way broadband system. With our national organizations and with funding from the Department of Homeland Security, we are working on a digital emergency alerting system that is much more robust and provides quicker, more reliable, and critical information in all areas. In fact, we have an application now that will not just put out the AMBER and the emergency alert systems to radios and televisions, but will put it through cell phone networks. I've demonstrated that for the Joint Committee on Technology last summer. We have shown that to General Reese and the head of the Oregon Emergency Management Agency, and we think that there could be a very important role that this system could play as the state looks at its emergency communications infrastructure, and particularly alerts. One idea that we have talked about is using our translator network along the coast once it's digital as a way of developing a much more reliable tsunami alert system that could not just you know, inform televisions, but cell phones and even portable signs as to evacuation routes, et cetera, et cetera. So there really is quite an opportunity here in addition to having this problem. There's more I could say, but I want to allow time for questions, as I'm sure there are some. I think it's fair to say that we are at an important turning point here for the provision of public broadcasting services within the state of Oregon. This digital transition is really putting us in a time where sometime during this legislative session, we are going to have to deal with this. Unfortunately, I don't think that the federal government is going to give us any more time. I have a personal friend who's a commissioner at the FCC, and I met with her not long ago and said, is there any chance that this is going to get pushed back? And her advice was, no, it will not get pushed back. They're dead set on moving forward with this. So we really do need to deal with this issue, and that's one of the main reasons that we're before you. So whether it's through Senate Bill 5502, in which we're included right now, or some other funding package that might put us together with other similar organizations, that is entirely up to the legislature as to do with that. I just would love to have this have due consideration and look forward to working with you on that.
Sure. Representative,
Mr. Bass, I have to say I'm a little disappointed. I was expecting Click and Clack, the Tappert Brothers, to be here before us today, so I have...
They don't travel.
Okay. It's also unfortunate, the timing, as I drove to work this morning listening to Pledge Week. So,
it's unfortunate for us as
it
well.
It is yes. Very brutal, but I understand.
Not something that we like to do, but
right. No.
Necessary.
So I actually have three questions, really, and I think the third might be more for committee members. So, number one, could you just talk a little bit about how funding works from the corporation, from CPB. And the reason I ask, was it Joan Kroc who gave a rather large sum to the corporation and public broadcasting?
It actually was to National Public Radio.
It was to National Public Radio, so you get no funding from them
whatsoever. Do you want me to address this now, or do you want to give me all the questions?
Let me finish
sure.
the last one. As you're talking about infrastructure and safety concerns, and I just keep thinking about the Owen Project, and I don't know how involved you are, Senator Johnson, or anyone else on this panel. I don't know if you even
are. I am familiar with it.
So I'm just wondering if there's any sort of type of coordination, or especially when we're talking about a $665 million. So that's just something I'm curious about. I guess I'm asking you and members of the panel. And then last, I would just a little plug, in terms of public service, would love to have the show 7 Days come back.
Yeah.
Maybe the only 90 people that watched it were legislators. But decisions that happen in this building obviously have enormous impact on people's lives, whether they like those decisions or not. And granted, Friday night at 8:30 or whenever the show was on is a difficult time, but that was, I think, a valuable public service. So anyway,
well, let me deal with those in order. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting is a quasi-private organization chartered by the Congress, and what they do is they take the federal appropriated funds and distribute it to public television and radio stations around the state. The money comes in two forms. First, there is what's called a base grant that's an equal amount that every station gets, and then there's an incentive portion that is related to the amount of non-federal support that each station raises. So the more, and it kind of comes back to the question Senator Johnson had for the previous group, is what's the validation from outside funding? That's really how it's established. The more we raise from viewers, listeners, foundations, state government, wherever, the greater the match we get from CPB. Joan Kroc, about 2 years ago, gave an extraordinarily large bequest to National Public Radio, of which OPB is a member. It was about $220 million. It has been put in an endowment, and they are using the proceeds from the endowment to help offset the cost of news and other programming. So while we might have wanted our proportionate share to come down to us, and frankly as one of the most listened to public radio stations in the country, we would have had a nice claim to that. It didn't work that way. So we still do pay about $1.2 million a year to NPR for the programming they provide, but they have been able to greatly expand that. I will also mention to you that endowments are something that we have been working on as well, because it's a very reliable source of support. But none of that did come to us. With regard to the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network, we have spoken with Mike Zanin and before that the consultants that were working on that. It has some similarities to what we're doing, but also some significant differences. They are looking at a system, as I understand it, to provide the ability for public safety agencies and others to talk on the same frequencies. What we're talking about is essentially a push system that can push information out in a very reliable and a very quick manner. There are some similarities there. We have talked with them about the possibility and the good sense of us sharing facilities. So as an example, if we were to do something on the coast for tsunami alerting, and it would make sense for us to put a digital translator in a place where there were no people on a permanent basis, but strategically for tsunami alerting, that would make sense. We would want to talk with them about gaining access to, say, state police or other sites where we could place that. There might be more that we can do, but obviously, you know, they're going to be driven by their particular needs, and we're certainly open to however we can work together. And as for your plug for 7 days, I have heard that before. A couple of things that I would mention to you, some investments that we have made. On the radio side, we have added a full-time reporter here in Salem, a guy named Chris Lehman. He may have been the one that came up with Senator Welch's, and if so, I'll chat with him about that. He's brand new. We are also now working on the radio side for a daily, we don't like to call it a talk show, but it is going to be a conversation show both on radio and on the internet. And one of the thoughts we have is that we may also take that onto television, but that's a little ways off. But I have heard that. I've never had the opportunity to see 7 days. I know there are people that miss it, and it is something that we are trying to figure out what and how to do that.
Senator Johnson.
A couple of comments and a question. The first one is a comment. Colleagues, today for the first time in this building, I think you have seen the rollout of a cultural package that is included in the governor's budget. For many of us who survived the special sessions and the downturn in 2001, when we essentially denuded the cultural landscape, there has been a pent-up desire to try to restore that. We measure, I think, livability in terms of some of the cultural accoutrements that are available in a place, and that people would make decisions to come to Oregon based on total livability. We basically strip mined the cultural landscape here. It was the first stuff cut, and I think in many cases, sadly, appropriately. We were making the decision, do you put grandma on the ice floe or do you support the arts? And the arts, as frequently happens, got cut. And so today, Mr. Bass comes here as part of a much more fully developed arts and culture proposal that you will hear euphemistically referred to as CHAMP in the building. This is culture, history, arts, movies, and preservation. And while all of the elements of the CHAMP package will come and make their case to legislators independently, they all are part of this overall cultural package that will look to try to bring some money back to the arts, back to the Oregon Historical Society, which is a repository for all of Oregon's physical treasures. 100 years ago, the state made a deal with OHS to take care of the physical artifacts that were brought. We take good care of our written record over at the Archives Building, but the Historical Society is really the repository of our tangible history. And they have had a partnership with the state for 100 years, that was cut off summarily. And so they're in this package as well. So today's the first time that you have heard the unveiling of an attempt to try to bring some of the livability back to Oregon by fiscally incentivizing the resurgence of the arts. and I think that's a very good thing. My question is, what did you do with the $7 million?
The $7 million was used to build build the digital transmitter facilities in Portland, Eugene, Corvallis, Medford, Klamath Falls, Bend, LeGrand, and I missed one. There were seven of them.
All spent, projects all completed.
The project is nearly completed. We got the Bend. The Bend transmitter was the last one to go on the air. That was this in the fall. Some of it also paid for upgrading the interconnection system amongst and between those, upgrading our network facilities. There may be a little bit of money left from the $7 million. We've accounted for it very carefully, but there's not much.
Mr. Chair, respectfully, I'd like to ask for two fiscal displays. One of them would be the accounting of the $7 million, and the second thing would be a breakdown of the money that comes to the state from federal sources through the CPB in a pie chart versus the state support versus the listener and viewer support. And I think that it's fascinating that you've come up to 63% private support, in no small measure beating the hell out of the legislature. So I'd like to think that we gave you a glorious marketing opportunity to increase your pledge drive participation.
Well, you may have done that. Whether that was the intent or not, I don't know. But we could certainly pull that together. I would say, Senator, that it's actually not 63% in private support. It's actually over 80. When you count the corporate and the like. And what we'll try to do, it gets a little complicated because we do also do a variety of national television productions which are kind of ancillary to our operating support. But we will put that together for you.
You can do that. That shows earned revenue, corporate support, member support, CPB support, and public support from the state legislature, all sources.
Absolutely. We can do that.
You know, no good deed goes unrewarded. One thing that's not mentioned is we've seen an enormous cost increase in the cost of power on our stations. So when you look at the operating budget, you have to look at the increases that have come about in the whole organization that include a lot of things that basically people don't think about when they're dealing with a broadcasting system.
Mr. Chair. Senator, Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm fascinated with your comments relative to the data casting and the capacity of 13T1 data lines. My question is, would this open up, once this goes digital, or I guess it is digital already, will this open up the opportunity for you, as you know, virtual schools are growing in our state, they're going to continue to grow, if we take care of a minor little problem. Anyway, would this give an opportunity for you to potentially contract with the providers of those virtual school programs to provide a high-speed connection for students that are in highly remote areas?
It would open up all sorts of opportunities like that. We have had some conversations with education folks, particularly higher ed. We have had some conversations with those involved with rural health care. We see some applications there, but I think that K-12 and even pre-K could be opportunities there. I think part of the challenge we've had here is it's almost an awareness challenge. You know, when I go in and I talk to state agency heads, and I've had this challenge in Tennessee before I was here, is when you go in and talk to the Homeland Security people or even the education people, you know, they tend to say, well, what does the guy that brings you Masterpiece Theater and Sesame Street have to do with virtual schools or public safety? So there's a challenge there in terms of awareness. But I will say that we have this system up and running and can do demonstrations and have done some. We can't do demonstrations where we don't have the digital signal coverage. You have to remember this is only limited to where we get digital coverage right now. So here's a good place. We can get it in Salem quite well. But can't carry it out into the rural areas yet. But once we make the investment and get the infrastructure upgraded across the state, we absolutely can do that.
Well, follow up, Mr. Chair, very quickly. So what I'm hearing you say is that once you get all of your digital facilities in place, this map of Oregon, in more ways than one, will be completely blue.
Almost.
Oregon already is completely blue.
I have a slight intonation there. if you notice that.
I think maybe I should use another color the next time, not meaning to be partisan in our coverage there.
Purple would be good.
I would say the best way to look at it would be on the previous sheet. It will show you where the various current transmitters and translators are. I mean, we do tend to put translators where there's population, not where there is no population. So the coverage would be significantly enhanced from what you're seeing on the last sheet, but I would not say that that the entire state would be covered with blue or whatever color you wanted to use to represent the broadcast coverage.
Thank you. The reason why I ask is because I have students in Chiloquin that can't get a high-speed connection. I have students in Wagon Tire.
Okay.
You know, most people don't know where Wagon Tire is, and being able to have a high-speed connection would be.
I believe we have.
Silver Lake.
Yeah, and Smith.
In fact, we have a radio translator in Wagon Tire, but we have a TV translator in Paisley. I'm not quite that familiar with the terrain down there as to whether one reaches the other, but I suspect, and that's also we could look at where do we place these for the future. This PASS system was kind of built on a patchwork based on technology and thinking, you know, 20, 30 years ago. We actually have an opportunity now to look at it in a different basis and figure out if we need to put something in a place to reach a rural school population. We can look at all of those factors going forward.
Thank you. Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry for being pulled in up by Senator Avakian all morning. He's got a problem. He's beating up on DAQ, but he does have a message for you. He's a big supporter of OPB, and he told me just get them the money, so I don't know what that is. He actually said that out there. Couple of questions real quickly. I assume these packages are all wrapped up together for Southern Oregon Television along with OPB.
Correct.
Right? I just want to make sure that's clear.
Yes.
And I understand, I think fairly clearly, the huge hurdle you're facing here in 09. We have to respond to that in some way, and I think what you're doing is appropriate. What I wanted to do was to tag on some of the questions that the good senator to my left had. What I heard was, I think, that there's some match money involved in this with the feds. I want to make sure we're not leaving any of that on the table. And so what I'd like to see when you bring information back to us is to make sure we've matched our money up properly and have not left anything on the table to do that. I expect you have. You've got all the match money you can get, but I want to make sure that's there. So if you bring that to us also, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. So I would presume you mean with the $7 million on that.
I want to know if there's any match money for operating expenses or any other expenses that have been left on the table because of lack of funding.
Okay.
Okay, that's the question I have. I don't want to be losing any match money here that has happened. Again, as Senator Johnson has said, we were in the worst recession the state's seen since 1932. We're taking people off a health plan who literally probably died because of that.
Yeah.
Now it's time to reinvest in the culture in this state. You know, one of the questions, why did people move to Oregon? This is one of the reasons. And my people in Southern Oregon tell me that Oregon is an anomaly in the country as far as number of people by percentage of population that listen to public broadcasting and watch public broadcasting. So this is something Oregonians really want. My numbers, I vaguely remember, it's most of the country, about 3 to 5% listen to public broadcasting or watch public television. But in Oregon, it's something like 30%, 40%. It's a huge number differential there. So we are serving a need the public wants, and that's one of the reasons I support this. The problems you're going to face with high-density, high-definition TV and digital are going to be, I'm afraid, bigger than you're thinking here, potentially. And what I'd ask also when you bring this financial package to us, to make sure it's the one you need, that you right-sized it as far as, so you're not coming back in a year or two saying, gee, we made a mistake, we needed more, didn't get enough done. I know these things are hard to predict, but you've got to give us the real thing right up front so we can potentially deal with it.
Yeah.
And the last question is a rather simple one, and one I've asked a few other people that can't tell me. The lights go off for TV sets for some people in 09. Do we have any idea how many people have pure analog TV sets left in their homes? Because what I'm thinking is if it's a significant number, the feds are going to hear about it, and we may get some extra time. Because when they flip that thing over one day and say, tomorrow you haven't got any television, and you have to go buy a new TV set, if it's a significant part of the population, I have seen the feds turn it a dime when they have to.
Yeah. There are a couple things going on there. The last data that I heard, and this was maybe a year or so old, is that they were still selling 25 million analog TV sets a year. So I would say that the penetration of analog TV sets is significant.
Anybody know the number?
I'm sure the Electronics Association does. But let me tell you a little bit about the way the federal government is thinking this through. That may be true.
Okay.
First of all, their plan is to mount a fairly significant education effort in the next few months to get people to understand what is going to happen on February 17, 2009. Secondly, they are going to issue vouchers to homes that rely on broadcast television only that will subsidize the cost or part of the cost of a set-top converter box. Essentially, if you have an analog set, and I've done this in my own home, if you get one of these boxes, you can hook up your current TV set to it. And what's actually kind of cool about it is in my home, I can actually pull down off the air the Oregon channel, our regular channel, and a third channel that we're broadcasting on there. The problem is that the electronics stores are much more interested in selling you a new $1,500 HD set than they are in selling you a $100 box. So we're going to be facing a significant education effort here. The other thing is that there are significant numbers of people in the state of Oregon who rely only on broadcast television. And the highest percentage that I have seen almost anywhere in the country, interestingly enough, is in Multnomah County. About a third of all the homes there don't take cable or satellite, and they rely only on broadcast television. So it's a fairly significant number in certain areas. And we've also looked at it enough that it does not necessarily, one would think that it might have an income skew to it, and it doesn't necessarily have that. So it's kind of an interesting phenomenon out there. But you're right, they may end up on February 18th deciding to turn it back on, but at this point they're not telling us they're not going to turn it off.
People riot.
Sorry about that.
Well, companies are going to look at
Chair's going to end this editorializing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
And to conclude this, but would make one observation that you indicate you tend to put transmitters in the area's population. Would suggest that certainly is not true in the Eastern Oregon area that I represent. The transmitter is in La Grande. The population is in Umatilla County. And if we look at Umatilla County, and by the way, I would think your map is probably underestimating or undershowing the population in Pendleton. But that's a trivia point. But if you look at that area that is not covered there, that's, you know, a fairly significant
Absolutely.
Population compared to the rest of eastern Eastern Oregon.
Could I comment on that just for a second? The reason we have the transmitter in La Grande and not further to where the population is because those are licensed by the FCC, and we can only put them in certain places. So we've got one that's kind of... But you're right.
But it does, as your blue indicates, absolutely no good to the population.
Exactly.
That we have there. And, of course, the FCC and their infinite wisdom as far as some of the other means of receiving television and this in the satellite programming, you know, we get the pleasure and privilege of... listening to the Tri-City stations rather than the Oregon stations. And quite frankly, I heard, and it's none of your concern, but I heard more about the Maria Cantwell campaign than I really needed or cared to know.
I will say we are working to try and change federal policy on that because I think that Oregon residents should be getting Oregon television stations.
Thank you. We do appreciate anything that anyone does to try to try to deal because there is. You talk about Multnomah County has the broadcast Umatilla County has no broadcast television. We're in somewhat... pardon me?
You have no local broadcast at all?
No.
Well, we would be there with broadcast.
Yeah, yeah. So, with that, then so much, and I'm sorry if I cut somebody else off on questions, but we want to move on. We have public testimony from Joe, is it Schaffer? Schaefer.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time.
And I appreciate very much your being here, and you've got a good news and bad news as far as the chair is concerned. You have one of these constituents that's telling me to cut your budget in half. You have another constituent telling me that it isn't enough. And the good news is that...
you're going to listen to your constituents.
The good news is... Good morning, Joe.
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, my name is Joe Schaefer. I live here in Salem, but I work for the Oregon for the Service Employees International Union, and we represent workers at OPB on the television side. More than that, I've been a member of OPB for about 8 years, and I can tell you right about now at my house, I've got 2-year-old twins and a 1-year-old who are turning off Sesame Street about this time. And as a parent, OPB TV has always been important to me as an individual for the news hour and a lot of the public affairs programming. I'm a pretty avid news geek, and they're my like major fix every day. But as a parent, there really is no replacement for the children's programming that OPB puts on. The closest thing you have would be the Disney Channel, but that type of commercial broadcasting is not really what you want your 2-year-olds watching. But the Sesame Workshop does an amazing job of the basic education that I know my family relies on it quite a bit, because my wife is a stay-at-home mom, and with 3 little kids, the cabin fever starts to set in every day, and I know that having that break to help our kids out really means a lot to us. But I did want to comment about one thing that really disappointed me about the presentation this morning. Was that when the state lost its funding for OPB, our members there took a tremendous cut in pay and benefits. Their out-of-pocket costs on health care went through the roof. I don't know the exact numbers on where it ended up in bargaining, but management was proposing increasing out-of-pocket costs for family health care coverage there to be over $600 a month. And so, you know, I'm really excited about the opportunities to invest in the physical infrastructure of OPB. I know that I've suffered the gaps in programming in my long drives out to Klamath Falls many times, and out to Pendleton and LeGrand. And so those things are important to me. Even though I live here in the Valley, I do see like a tremendous need for the physical infrastructure. And though in the presentation this morning I didn't hear any intentions about investing in the human infrastructure that makes that all work, I do hope that some state support there helps alleviate that pressure on our members. That, you know, as the state took the economic downturn, very few people, you know, made the sacrifices that our members did, both at OPB and in our local governments and state government units. They made a tremendous sacrifice for the state in that downturn, and I'd like to see that sacrifice at least respected or given, you know, it's due consideration when there's testimony here before the legislature. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for Joe? Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to stand in recess for just a few seconds and... we are back in session, and we are adjourned for the day.